Citizen Coordinator, and this is his weekly briefing. Now, the idea is that they have been meeting three times a week. They've been fairly informal meetings, and only lasted about 10 minutes. Some of the ongoing projects were not mentioned at every meeting because they were ongoing, so they just talked about the major things. So Admiral Robbins decided that they would meet once a week and make a more formal presentation of everything that's going on. So as you can hear in the background, the room is definitely filling up. And this room is a little bit larger than one over at DEC. Exxon offered it as a meeting place because it has the capabilities of showing computer projections and slides and videotapes and just quite a lot. They use this as a briefing room for new people that come on staff and for visiting dignitaries and for, of course, the press. So Admiral Robbins has just arrived, and I think we'll be starting fairly soon. After this, now this meeting is on Thursday because of the DEC hearings, which were held on Tuesday. After this, though, they will always be on Tuesday nights. We'll expect a briefing from Exxon and from DEC and from various others, committees, the Interagency Shoreline Cleanup Committee, and a few others will be speaking. And it gives a chance, too, having it once a week, for the people who are out in the field to come in and make their presentations of what they're actually seeing. Robbins has arrived, and we'll see how things are going. We're bringing out the daily summaries. I'm going to move some microphones around so we make sure we've got Admiral Robbins clearly. As you know, the main players are Exxon and DEC, but this is a good time to hear from all the different scientists that are out in the field that have their study plots going. And it's amazing, as long as this has been going, and this is day 120, I think, we're talking 4 months into the spill, and a lot of activity is going on in the sound. It's still a really relaxed atmosphere in here, even though it is supposedly a much more formal meeting than has been held before.
We're busy searching for more chairs to bring in.
Everything's really filling up. Steve Provant has just shown up for DEC. We may have all the players soon.
I should say all the acronyms are filling in instead of all the people.
I see
one vacant chair in the room.
These meetings will be open to the public if you can find room in here. That's one of the reasons we're trying to broadcast it live for you, so that you will be able to know what's going on without having to go through the security clearance and get into this room. They have not got it set up yet in order for people to ask questions. The Admiral was very clear that it's still in the formulating stages and that they won't be able to do a question-answer period. They expect it to go on for approximately an hour and a half to two was his original projected time. And we're going to start.
Can you do it specifically with this mic, or can it just sit here looking at us like it's looking at us?
You can just talk right to it. And if the people who are giving you a tour circle, I'll just talk to the
admin. All right.
One thing I might mention is just a brief safety message at first in case of need to evacuate. There is the one exit at your back, marked exit. And And you turn and go down the stairs that you came up in. Just in case there is a need to evacuate the room, we always like to mention that at first so you don't go out the windows.
There's also an exit straight back through the hall.
Right, there's a secondary exit straight back through this hall to your left. To take another left and it goes out the back of the building.
There you are.
Right. You want to go ahead and do the report?
Yes, sir.
You going to get
it? Yeah, sure will. Say, I'll begin with the Exxon report tonight, and following my report, Chipper Logie will have a special topic tonight to talk about some of the weather data that we've gathered that's an integral part of the demobilization plan that we're developing. Beginning with our weekly report, I'll start by emphasizing safety on the summary page. This is for the week ending July the 20th. As you can see from the report, there were no Exxon injuries during the week. There were a total of 7 contractor injuries, 7 lost time, 1 restricted work, and 3 medical treatment. And safety continues to be a high area of emphasis for all of the supervisors, both Exxon and contractor in Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska. Moving down to equipment deployment. We've reached slightly over a total of 1,000 vessels, 1,006, 39 skimmers deployed. Aircraft seems to be missing from the page, but it's about 70. Booms deployed, 420,000 feet, 240,000 of that in Prince William Sound, and 200,000 feet in the Gulf of Alaska. Another 140,000 feet of boom available to be deployed if needed. Looking at shoreline operations for progress for the last week, we had a total of 20.5 miles treated in Prince William Sound, an additional 67 miles in the Gulf of Alaska for a total of 87.5 miles. I've also listed the data for yesterday, and it was a good day both in the Sound and Gulf of Alaska, 4.3 miles in the Sound and almost 20 miles in the Gulf of Alaska for a total of 24 miles yesterday. That brings our cumulative miles treated to date to 565 miles. Equipment deployment for shoreline cleaning, 48 landing craft, 25 barges, and 19 berthing vessels. Oil recovered for the week, 1,184 barrels, including 114 barrels yesterday. Over 36,000 feet of boom cleaned during the week, 5,000 of that yesterday. And total personnel has reached a peak of 10,915 people involved in the total cleanup. On the next page, I've got a graph here of Exxon shoreline progress, both for Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska through July the 19th yesterday. And that is plotted, as you can see, by day. Total miles in Prince William Sound, 124.9, Gulf of Alaska, 440.1. And in Prince William Sound, as indicated on this chart, we've made an adjustment, a single one-time adjustment today to reflect some ongoing discussions we've had on going to a new database. We've had discussions with several of the agencies in the Coast Guard over the last few weeks to discuss going to a new digitized database. And this reflects that change. There's an explanation of that on the page behind there. And I'll call your attention to a couple of points in that. And that is that there was a one-time reduction from the digitized database versus the SCAT report estimates on the segment lengths of 12.2 miles. And that was more than offset by an adjustment of 33.7 miles. And that accounts for the impacted links in the database for segments that have now been approved by the Coast Guard as requiring no treatment, but in our total database of the 345 miles to be treated. So from this point on, we'll be using this database for further progress reports. Let me move next to Prince William Sound shoreline activities. under accomplishments and issues, I'll mention the first Corky out there because it's really pertinent to both Prince William Sound and Gulf of Alaska. And that is in terms of chemical utilization. Our opinion is that approval and wide-scale use of core exit and bioremediation no later than the first week in August would significantly enhance the speed and the effectiveness of shoreline treatment during the remainder of the summer. I know there's ongoing evaluation of that. We hope for a speedy resolution. We think it's very important to our future progress. Beyond that, let me introduce Wayne Voskamp and Scott Nauman. Wayne and Scott are the task force coordinators for the effort in Prince William Sound, and they'll cover the highlights that we've had for the last week.
Not sure how we're going to work this as far as the microphones. I'm Scott Nauman. This is Wayne Voskamp. I'm the task force coordinator for task forces 3, 4, and 5. Wayne has task forces 1, 2, and 6. If I could, and I'll step away from the microphone,
just to get you oriented geographically where the task forces are situated right now, working north to south. Task Force 4 is up here in the northwest bay area. Task Force 2 is deployed in Upper Passage and beginning to move into Lower Passage. Task Force 3 is here in Herring Bay. Task Force 5, which we've recently started up, is in Lower Herring Bay, and I'll mention a few things about it in a moment. Task Force 1 is down in the Evans Island area, and then Task Force 6 is just beginning to take shape across the passage over in the Shannon Bay area. What I'd like to do is just give you a brief update on what each of the task forces is doing, where they've been in the past week. I mentioned Task Force 4 is situated in the Northwest Bay area. We are currently working on the outside of the bay for the most part. We have work ongoing in the northwest portion of the bay itself. The bulk of our activity is out on the eastern face of Eleanor Island. We've been making good progress in the last week. These are areas which were heavily oiled. We're trying to take advantage of the good weather that we've been having, mobilizing outside of the bay and trying to hit these areas that are exposed. That leaves us the fallback position on bad weather days to come and work within the bay. So from a strategy standpoint, we're attempting to take advantage of the weather. Task Force 2, which I mentioned is Wayne's, is located in the Upper Passage area, just south of Task Force 4. They have been focusing their work in the Upper Passage area, but as you can see by the lines on here, are now deploying into the Lower Passage area and working Disk Island and then the very upper portion of Knight Island. I continue down south, come to Task Force 3, which, as I mentioned earlier, is located geographically in Herring Bay. Again, this is an area that was heavily oiled. We've made good progress, particularly here in the last week. We've completed our treatment for the most part on the western coast or western face of Herring Bay. We're currently deployed on Knight 133, which is a chain of islands here. That's where the bulk of our activity is focused now. And our movement, generally speaking, will be to the eastern face, working up and out of the bay. Again, the good weather has been beneficial to us, and we're beginning to move this direction up and out of Herring Bay. Last one I'll mention here, and again, working further south, is Task Force 5, which is in Lower Herring Bay. Task Force 5 has been an entity for just over a week. I'll mention a few things about it. We started with the first four. Wayne will tell you a little bit about Task Force 6 in a minute. Task Force 5, as I mentioned, has been in existence for about a week. We brought in two berthing vessels. The first was the Crowley 312-2. Houses approximately 200 people. Followed that up just a couple of days later with McDermott Derrick Barge 100.
which is probably the most recognizable berthing vessel we've got. Approximately 500 beds. It's a semi-submersible derrick barge. It has a 2,000-ton crane on it. Its use is primarily North Sea platform setting. We have it in Lower Herring Bay and are utilizing it for berthing space. So I mentioned Task Force 5 has gotten a quick start. They're working the areas right now north of Lower Herring Bay. They're coming out of the bay and working up the western face of Knight Island. We've gotten, as I said, a good start. I've completed most of our work in the upper two-thirds of this section here. Have a little bit of work to do as we move south towards Lower Herring. The geographic area of 5 is much larger than the others. That reflects the degree of oiling we had as you go further south. In general, we look for Task Force 5 to be a flexible task force that can move quickly and hit small areas, and we're seeing some success in that kind of strategy. We'll move once we complete the area we're working now. We have two main directions we'll be working with Task Force 5. That's south along the western face of Knight Island. We'll also go across and hit the eastern coast of Chinega Island. Again, all the task forces are operational in this area and having good success with the weather in the last week. I'll turn it over to Wayne, and he'll tell you a little bit about Task Force 6, which is just getting underway now.
Continuing on through the sound, I'll hit Task Force 6 plus some of the other operating areas that Scott did not talk about. First of all, showing the initial deployment area for Task Force 6. We plan this task force to begin operation in the Oshami Bay region. At this point in time, the task force is not operational, but the first berthing vessel is at anchor in the Oshami Bay right about at this point. It's being assembled and readied for people. Plan is to begin movement of people onto that vessel tomorrow afternoon and evening, with operations starting this weekend. This task force will ultimately end up similar to the others, with probably about two maxi-type barge units and two omni-type barge units and somewhere around seven landing craft. The operating area will be virtually the entire area that's on this map and will be weather dependent. On good weather days, the task group will deploy to those areas that are exposed, and then on poor weather days into other areas that are more protected. Moving from this area to the Latouche region, Task Force 1 has been in Latouche for several days and has been operating northern sectors of that island and up to July the 15th. After the 15th, Task Force 1 moved out of the area consistent with the Sawmill Bay fishing season. I'll show you the areas that Task Force 1 worked before they moved out after the 15th. They worked all of these sectors from LA 24 on around the point, Sleepy Bay, up to LA 15. Also, there's a Chinega Native work group that's a part of this task force, and that work group worked Bates Island. All of the off five segments of Bates Island were worked by this group. Starting the 16th, they moved to a new place of deployment up to Shelter Bay in Evans Island. At this point in time, the Bering Trader is anchored in Shelter Bay. The initial work areas are shown here, the northern point up to Evans Point and then down on into the Shelter Bay area on the east side. The Chinega Native group continues to be a part of this task force, and they're working these sectors west of Evans Point on a non-washing basis, strictly hand work to clean up that area, which is a subsistence area. The Shelter Bay work is moving fairly rapidly, and I think we'll be out of that work area probably after tomorrow, and this weekend will be deployed over to the western sectors of around the point there, and by early next week probably up to Fleming Island, and beyond that throughout the week. There was one other topic I wanted to mention before closing, and that would be the anadromous fish streams and our status with them. We had been working to clean up several of these streams prior to today, July the 20th, which included two streams in Herring Bay, one on Latouche, Sleepy Bay, three streams on Evans Island, one in Marsha Bay, two on Chenega Island, and one in the Bay of Isles. We have been successful in getting all these streams cleaned by today, and hope that they'll be in good shape for the spawning season. That's a summary of our operations in the rest of the Sound. Scott and I would receive any questions.
Questions?
We, in terms of bed space in five, have, as I mentioned, roughly 500 on the derrick barge, 200 on the Sealy 312. We are, I think, at a point of plus or minus 100 empty beds now, so in the range of 550 to 600 people, which puts us at a level that we would say is currently staffed appropriately. If I'm not mistaken, Task Force 6 will be similarly sized in the neighborhood of 500 plus or minus people. Those two would be roughly consistent with our other four task forces. There's one other thing I wanted to mention before we stop, and that refers to some of the tools we have at our disposal and where we stand on the development of those. I think, as many of you know, the Omni boom and barge is one of our key pieces of equipment. We've been going through a program retrofitting those barges with PVI six-pack heaters, as we call them, to enhance our warm water capability off the Omni barges. That program is nearing completion. We've got 11 of the 13 Omnis retrofitted, which we see as being a key step in terms of developing our tools. One area that we're embarking on and really about a third of the way through is supplying heaters to our landing craft similar to those on the Omni barges. We're taking a two-pack, which is basically just a one-third segment of what we have on the Omnis, and retrofitting them into landing craft. We've done this on six of the landing craft. We plan to do it on 15 total. What's significant about that is that not only does it enhance our overall warm water capability, but by installing the heaters in the landing craft, which are more maneuverable and more flexible, we believe that we'll become more efficient in handling some of the areas that either A, are lightly oiled or oiled in just small coves, and enhance our ability to move in and out. And also just being able to deploy in areas where the shoreline restricts us from moving in the larger barges. So from a tools of the trade standpoint, we're making progress. The big barges are essentially complete in terms of the retrofits. The landing craft vessels, as I mentioned, we've got six of 15 and would anticipate in the next 2 weeks to have the remainder of that 15 outfitted and ready for use. Don't have any other questions, I'll turn it back to you, Bill.
Okay, just a couple other overall highlights on the Sound, and that is that we did reach a total of about 2,300 direct shoreline workers yesterday. And over the week, we received Coast Guard approval for demobilization on 33 segments. I'll move now to the Gulf of Alaska activities, which begins on page 11 of your report. Starting with Kodiak, accomplishments for the week, 611 shoreline workers yesterday, completed treatment of about 66 and a half miles during the last week. A net washing facility for fishing nets was completed at Kodiak and is now ready for service. received Coast Guard demobilization approval of one segment, K-6-2. And we have increased our SCAT teams in Kodiak now to a total of four teams, and also established a SCAT coordination center similar to the center in Valdez. Now we have a second center located in Kodiak. In near-term activities in Kodiak area, we do plan to complete a test of hot water washing techniques that's being conducted at Point Bank, which is the northern end of Shuyak Island. And participating in a survey with the Coast Guard and other agencies to establish demobilization approval standards in the Kodiak area, and we hope that that will then gain help us gain approval of a number of segments where demobilization approval is pending. We are working on a plan, and a preliminary plan is being reviewed by my people now for treating the remaining shoreline areas in the entire Kodiak area. And we're also completing arrangements for additional berthing vessels to provide it, for expanded cleanup operations. Moving on to Homer, 193 shoreline cleanup technicians completed about 0.4 of a mile treated during the past week. That's in addition to retreatment of areas that have re-oiled. I think we mentioned at the last meeting, we discussed the test burn of oil logs at Rocky Bay. We have received Coast Guard demobilization approval on five segments in Homer and awaiting approval of 24 or more in that area. Some weather, I think the recent visits that you made in trying to get a pretty consistent view on criteria will help a lot, is what I've heard back from my own people.
A number of these are, again, sign-offs on beaches that were standard, but we're not actually over patching. And a bunch of those have been by us, the cars and all the sign-offs. When you look out something on that, that's a procedure, or if we're going to call on those, we're going to try and handle it some other way. The ones where we're not working that accomplished. But it just seems like it's a waste of Coast Guard in our time to have to go out and deal with those.
Yeah, we do need to work on that because if the SCAT team and ADEC agree that there's no oil there, why worry about it? Let's not make it work. We got enough to do.
No, I think that would certainly be acceptable to us, too. I think the original intent, and you discussed it one time, was just to have something from the record that all parties agree that the segment has been scattered and no treatment is required.
Yeah, I agree. I think it needs to be documented in some way. As long as we have a scan on it, I think, though, when getting a sign-off on it doesn't seem to be like that on the necessary, but you're right.
No, I just think we're looking for the major parties to agree that, no work is required in there.
Not appropriate
for
those
instances.
We might have to just
do some
other mechanism.
Yeah, we'll work. Okay. In the near term, we are beginning to move equipment and we'll soon follow the workforce into the Barren Islands now to safely, and I emphasize safely, initiate cleaning activities. As you know, that's one of the more remote spots we have to deal with, but we now believe that we have the equipment to deal with that safely, and looking forward to proceeding rapidly in the Barren Islands. And again, working on demobilization approval in that area. We do need to proceed with oil log burning along the Homer operating area. And Steve, I sent you a note today on our intent to proceed with that, with the first area again being in the Barren Islands, an area where there are a number of oil logs to be dealt with. We intend over the next week to extend Type B cleanup efforts into Chugach Bay while continuing Type B cleanup in Tansina Bay, which has been underway over the last week. And similar to the Kodiak area, to complete a segment-by-segment plan for completion of the remaining shoreline areas in the Homer area. In Seward, 115 shoreline cleanup technicians, about a tenth of a mile treated during the last week, again in addition to areas that have been recleaned. The dredge Essions was cleaning of that dredge was completed last week, and she sailed yesterday. And the mosquito fleet is continuing to net free moose and floating tarballs in the Nuka Island and Pile in areas. We're continuing Type A cleanup procedures at Yalik Glacier Beach. We intend to initiate, in fact did initiate yesterday, Type B cleanup efforts in Morning Cove, a large workforce in that area. And meeting a segment-by-segment plan for completion of all of the work in the Seward area, and working with the Coast Guard on demobilization approval for 7 segments in the Seward area that are pending. See, next we'd like to discuss our waste management and environmental report, and I'll ask Bob Goodrich to handle that area.
Okay, there's two major areas we'd like to discuss, the liquid and the solid oil waste. As you can see in the detailed numbers here and on the page 15, the oily solid waste progress charts show that we're doing fairly well in keeping even with the amount of solid waste generated, but there's still a gap of about 1,500 to 2,000 tons, and that's why we are requesting an expedited approval for the permits on those two large barge-mounted incinerators that have been out in the Port of Valdez now, waiting a week or so. On that same subject, the ADEC public hearings are ongoing this week. We have had one in Anchorage on Monday, Valdez Tuesday, and Seward on Wednesday. Homer is going on right now. We're surprised at the very few complaints and testimony that have been given on these, a very sort of low attendance, particularly in the Seward and the Valdez sessions. We're going to see how it goes again later this week at Homer and Kodiak. We've started up the chem waste management rebagging facility at Seward. We have one now in Anchorage that's been going on for quite a while. We're hoping to get that up to full operation pretty shortly. On the oily liquid waste, let's change this item here to approved. We've received approval from EPA and ADEC to treat these other oily waters at the Alyeska Ballast Water Treatment Facility. We received that approval about 5 o'clock today, and we certainly appreciate EPA's efforts and ADEC's concurrence on that. It's very important to not build up these wastewaters in our barges. We want to work them off responsibly in the Alyeska's treatment system. Also, we're preparing plans for the oily water separation and treatment of the boat, boom, gear, and equipment cleaning wastewaters. These are those wastewaters that have that biodegradable solvent in it, Desolvent and other firms, CitraClean. We've decided, along with ADEC and Alyeska, not to process that, at least at this stage, in their facilities. We'd rather handle it another way, by pre-treating it than putting it into either the City of Valdez system or in the treatment barge. On the sanitary wastewaters, the aerated treatment lagoon is in operation, but we're having problems meeting unique criteria that were given to us in an existing state permit. So the treated sewage is still going to the City of Valdez system. We have a tentative agreement.
What's the unique criteria?
Basically, low levels of effluent petroleum hydrocarbons and oil and grease. Much lower than most municipal treatment facilities in the United States have to meet. But we think we've got that worked. We've had ongoing discussions with ADEC and EPA on it, and we think we have a tentative agreement. That's a third item here that will come up with a more realistic effluent criteria. And so really what we're asking is we get an expedited revision on that existing permit, so that we'll be allowed to handle that sewage out in the Sound in this specially designed sewage treatment barge. Also, the city dock upgrade is expected to be complete on the 22nd of this month. And also, Exxon's providing a fair amount of assistance to the city to augment their treatment capability and help them with some of the operational problems they've had with their system. I think that's about all I wanted to cover. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have. Yes?
I was just wondering about the aerated treatment. Is that a
line? No, it's a specially designed barge out on the water that... Yeah, it's a little misleading, the term ATL, aerated treatment lagoon. It's the same type of thing you would have on the shore, but it's out on a barge.
Yes, sir. I have attached a detailed skimmer and boom report, but I don't intend to go through that. I guess to summarize, we feel that we've made significant progress both in the Sound and the Gulf of Alaska over the last week, and issues of critical importance to us at this time are approval of use of core exit bioremediation, demobilization approval on segments so that we all have a common view of the amount of work that's been accomplished, approval of waste management facilities that are critical to our further progress, and also approval of work plans and our own internal planning that that we would like to present to you at a later date so that we have a common view of the work remaining to be completed, especially in the Gulf of Alaska. So those are the points we wanted to cover, and okay with you, I'd now turn it over to Chipper.
There's a couple of things here. I had a couple of plots that can probably be best illustrated on a with an overhead projector here, if y'all bear with me just 1 second. We've been asked a lot of questions regarding demobilization, basically what, why, when. We've had discussions ongoing all along. The primary driving factor is, of course, the weather. We have stated over and over again, we're not going to subject people or our operations to weather conditions that we feel are unsafe. I've got a couple of things just to illustrate what our concerns are. Now, these are based on some very generalized data. These are data that come from the NOAA Climatic Atlas. It's a document NOAA, DOD, and I guess DOI have put together and do so on a yearly basis. And it's a long-term statistical area that covers very broad areas. Not specifically Prince William Sound, but areas somewhat greater than Prince William Sound. Now, I have a summary report that has most of these charts in it, and they'll be on the back table. I underestimated numbers of people, so just take one or two in agency. I think there are 40 copies, so there should be enough for people to pick up. I want to mention, this is very summary data. It illustrates the point. It was what caused us to be very concerned about trying to operate much beyond early September. We're doing very detailed studies at this time. Exxon Production Research Company's oceanographers are working with all available data. They've had discussions with NOAA, all of the local and other weather forecasting agencies, trying to build the best database they can to enable us to look into the details of what the weather might be in early fall. Now we will make an actual decision of when to demobilize based on the results of these studies. As I mentioned, they're ongoing studies. They're not complete yet, but they will be the trigger that we pull or that pulls us to start the demobilization efforts. All of our plans and the word that people have seen is based on a mid-September. This was the planning basis that we derived based on this generalized data and a lot of discussions with people with local knowledge. The people we talked to have told us that
you know, we would not be working in an environment that would be safe if we went beyond sometime in September. That might be 1st of September. It might be the end of September. The call will be made on the best data we have available. We'll keep everyone informed as we get these studies completed, as we get closer to the time that we actually start the demobilization. Now, let me show you a map that's really taken right out of NOAA Atlas and just transferred to another plot here to illustrate some of the difficulties we're looking at. The blue lines here are all of this, and it's the percent of waves that are greater than 8 feet. Look, in August, you have a 20% line. 20% of the waves are greater than 8 feet, which is way out in the Gulf of Alaska. That's the average in August. The same 20% line in September moves up, getting into the sound. Looking at the 20% line, of course, initially the 20% line, the 10% line in August, is basically right around the coastline, going on down to Kodiak and along the Kenai. By September, the 10% line moves right to the northern edge of Night Island. Well, basically what that is saying is the weather patterns, as September gets here, the wave conditions increase. We have a much greater chance to have severe wave conditions. As we move into September and October, it gets even worse. This was just an illustration. There are a couple of slides I have. If I can show them up here on the screen, you might have to dim the light. It's right by the exit door there. Switch the light off. Okay, that's good. This one basically just wind speed. And I think y'all can read the summer months, basically May, June, July, and August. This line is the wind conditions less than 17 knots. Now, what you see is winter months up through about April and starting in September, you get a very rapidly increasing number of days or percentage that you get wind conditions over 17 knots. I think the other thing of significance is these lower segments here is wind speeds greater than 40 knots. And you see virtually none reported through the May through August time frame. September through April, you see it built up to 1 or 2%, which isn't a large percentage. But if you have several thousand people offshore and get caught with something greater than 40 knot winds, we're asking for a lot of problems. These plots are in this little data summary that y'all can pick up, so I won't really dwell. Again, this is a generalized area, a very broad area that stretches well beyond the Gulf out into the Sound. Next slide, please. This is wave height data. Now, we have found out operationally that we get shut down in waves, again, depending on area, but one and a half meters, very, very difficult to work in. Same type of data, if we look at a three to three and a half meter wave line, again, fairly limited numbers of days or percentage that we have wave heights greater than that in the May through August time frame. Extremely rapid increase in September. During the winter, you get up almost 40% of the time. In this area, you're expecting wave heights of three and a half meters. Next slide. Temperature has not been as much of a concern. People say, well, you're going to shut down. It's not going to snow until later in the year. And as you can see, the mean temperatures, they fluctuate from an average in the mid-30s to 50s. The lowest temperature, which is shown on the bottom curve, starts going down pretty rapidly in September. Again, temperatures are not a concern as much as some of the other factors, although it makes working conditions extremely difficult as these temperatures start going down. We've got some other data in the little package that talks about hypothermia, length of time the person can stay in the water. And that data also strongly suggests that you don't want to have people out beyond the September-October time. Next slide, please. Another one we looked at, we have enjoyed some very long daylight hours. This is kind of a combination of things. The blue dots represent low tides and sunrise and sunset. What we're trying to do is say, all right, as time goes on, how much of the time do we have the opportunity to work when we have low tides, when we have light? We put a couple hour bands on each side because we're looking at some fairly long moves in some of these areas to move and get set up. And what you see is a pretty dramatic squeeze in time that you can actually operate in. Now this starts on September 1st. That compares roughly 8 to 10 hours in that time frame compared to 18 to 20 that we enjoyed in June. Now, we haven't done anything that tries to roll all these factors together and say, well, what happens if it's dark or if it's light, if you have bad weather? So there is a multiplying effect in here that we have not tried to do anything with. You can cut the slide projector off now. As I mentioned, we... hey, if you leave the light off just a minute, I mentioned we're doing some very detailed studies using all the detailed data that's available, and quite frankly, detailed data is pretty sparse. This is in Middleton Island, which is maybe, I think, 50 or 60 miles south of Hinchinbrook, so it's not totally representative of what's in the sound, but this is 1974 data for September, and what this has is wave heights. These are significant wave heights. This is a 10-foot wave, 15-foot wave, and our people at EPR have gotten all of this data that's available for every data buoy that we have in the Gulf of Alaska and anywhere in this area. They're currently analyzing all of this data. It's all on computer tapes. They're arraying it in many different ways to try to pick the weather ones. I think the thing of significance here, you look at September 1st, wave condition pretty little, 4 to 5 foot waves. You've got about 6 days of pretty good weather early September. Then you have a storm, you reach almost 20-foot wave heights. That subsides, and about 2 or 3 days later, you have another storm, and then that pattern pretty well continues. October gets worse, but difficulty is that you have just one storm after another with these 2 to 3 day windows in between. We think that's completely unsafe to try to operate. Again, this is out in the Gulf a little bit, but this weather can be extrapolated, or the wave conditions, wind conditions, into the sound, and this is what our people are trying to do. One other similar type of plot of interest, this is one of the NOAA data buoys, and it's arrayed in a bit of a different way. What we have here is basically days below 3 meter wave heights. And what we say is, all right, if we chose to start taking equipment down on this date, and this, just as an illustration, starts August the 1st, on a historical average, looking at the past 10 years weather data, how many days would you have before you got a storm with wave heights greater than 3 meters? So as you start up in here, your average storms are probably historically 10, 12 days apart. And you look what happens when you get out to early September. It basically says that you've got a couple of days between storms. That's the maximum weather window you have between conditions where you have wave heights greater than 3 meters. Again, this is from a data buoy that's out in the Gulf of Alaska. It's not Prince William Sound. But it's just an illustration of the types of data they're looking at, the ways they're looking at it. These data will be extrapolated into the sound to give us the best we can. You can click the light on now. So just in summary, for basically safety and operational reasons, Exxon does not plan to conduct any cleanup operation here in the winter. We're going to select the demobilization dates for all phases of operation, and these dates are going to be based strictly on safety and operational considerations. All of our equipment we plan to fully demobilize. We're going to have no equipment on the water this winter. And our commitment to the spring of 1990, and we have made a commitment, we will come back and survey the shorelines. And that is a commitment we've made at this time. We'll see what needs to be done at that time and make plans accordingly. As I say, there's a handout package that will be on the back which summarizes this data. We have gotten the detailed weather studies well underway. We'll share the results of those as soon as we get results from Exxon Production Research Company and keep you updated on where we stand. That's basically it. I'll try to answer any questions.
Questions?
Comments? Do you have any waypoint information from any buoys inside?
John, I don't think there are any buoys operational in the Sound. Some have been put in on occasion. They have what data is available, but quite frankly, there's very, very limited data from historical type of buoys. They put some in early on during the spill, but I think they were removed after several months of operation. We are looking at the possibility of putting some buoys in to get additional data. But our people have gone to every source of data we can think of. If you've got any suggestions or any knowledge of data outside of Coast Guard and NOAA or DOD, let us know, because our people were surprised there was not more actual data available.
I don't know of any specific data within the Sound, but I do know of Milton Island, one of the roughest places out in the Gulf.
We're going to have to use the best data, John, and our people are working with Gary Goff and some of the NOAA people, and it's not going to be just Exxon's own database. We're using other people's database. We're trying to use other people's experiences. Our fellow from EPR was up here this last week for the past week, and has talked to all the sources he can up here, including Lynn Crystal, who's the local weather person, who quite frankly said we would not be well advised to be out in certain areas of the Sound in September. The other thing that happens in September, weather becomes, as I understand, in talking with some of the local fishermen and others, becomes very, very unpredictable. Things can blow up very, very quickly. You can be on a sheltered side of an island, and things are called willy walls. Wind will build up basically on one side of the island, and then it's the effect of the wind spilling over. You actually have higher velocities on the downwind side of the island than you do the upwind side. If we can get better data, we'll do so. A lot of it has to be from local knowledge of people who've been here in boats and hunted and fished in these areas for years. We'll try to integrate the local knowledge data with the best scientific data we can.
I guess I hear what you're saying, and I understand the desire to completely demobilize, and right now I'm not ready to comment on that to any great length. I think that one of the things that we really are going to have to look at least in the early, in the fall, before the heavy weather sets in, is that there's going to have to be some surveillance flights, there's going to have to be some observation of what's happening, and if there's oil migrating, and it is capturable, somebody is going to have to capture it. I just can't afford to have oil floating around out there if it is capturable. Now, there will be times in winter storms, there's no way you could capture it if you could see it, but I think that those are the kind of things that we still have to work out.
Right.
We plan to have all areas shut down. We do not anticipate it to move the oil in the Gulf or in the
I hope you're right.
I hope we are too.
I think we all hope you're right. I will be delighted if that's so. Any other questions, comments?
How long is it going to take for the start to mobilize
We have plans underway It's not going to happen overnight. If you recognize, we've got over 1,000 vessels out here, some small vessels, some very, very large vessels. All of the LCVs and Maxis, 50 LCVs, 26 Maxis, have a lot of equipment on that has to be taken back off. We've got a number of our berthing vessels, the hotel ships that basically are barges with land camps built on top of them that have to be taken off. So it's just a mass of equipment. You know, we're not talking of months. I think we're talking of weeks, but certainly not 1 or 2 days.
So it's possible to keep the Admiral stuff that he needs to last?
Well, we will have ongoing conversations with Coast Guard, and we will try to demobilize in the optimum way to satisfy everyone.
Okay. How about ADEC? Would you like to give a report?
Yes,
thank you. Steve?
The RRT met here in Valdez today. That's the regional response team, and the purpose of the meeting was to look at coming up with test mechanism so that we could proceed with the getting information on corrects at 9580, and we did reach agreement on a test protocol, and that we hope that we can that it will be worked out with Exxon so that we can go ahead and get that information and proceed to get the information we feel we need in order to determine if it is safe to use corrects at 9580. And I do have copies of the protocol here that we can give Exxon tonight if you haven't received a copy already. Also, to follow up a little bit on what was said about the public hearings on the incinerators, there were a number of citizens here in Prince William, or in Valdez that and from the village of Chiniga that took advantage of the opportunity to question and comment on the potential incineration of the oily waste. And while not a lot of people have offered testimony, there were a lot of questions and good questions, and there were a number of people that did express concern over the incineration of waste. Regarding the numbers of people that attend, and I guess that's a matter of perception, having been to a lot of public hearings, when you get 100 people, as we did in Anchorage, we consider that a pretty successful hearing. And here in Valdez, I didn't count them, but I think we had about 30 or 35, maybe 40 people here. So considering the size of the community, of actual residents here, I thought that was a pretty good turnout for Valdez. I don't know how many turned out at Seward last night. Also, generally in the Gulf of Alaska, Kenai Kenai shoreline area there, out of Homer and Seward, primarily the types of treatment that have gone on there have been type A, which over there is considered manual picking up of oily debris, moose, and rock wiping. And Admiral Robbins and I went over and we met with and observed some of the operations over there, and after that meeting it was decided that some of those techniques that were being used over there weren't really accomplishing a whole lot, and it was suggested that they utilize some removal and test some washing operations on some of the beaches, and they were going to test washing in Chugach Bay, and if that's successful, then follow that up with additional washing operations in Tonsina Bay and Windy Bay, and then other areas that, where that would be a useful technique, as it's defined over there by ADEC and Coast Guard personnel. Also, we've had reports of continuing moose that's been coming ashore in Kodiak Island, and as a result of this, they're working on developing a testing plan for determining the source of the oil. Our hydrologist in Kodiak and the ADF&G Commercial Fisheries Division over there have designed a testing plan to sample the waters of Ugak Bay and Uganic Bay. And there have been persistent reports over there of submerged oil down to the 20 to 40 foot depth below the surface in the Shitakoff Straits. And anyway, we're curious about where that might come from or be coming from. Also, there's a effort over there through the Manned Undersea Sea Program through the National Marine Fisheries Service and NOAA, where we're expected to coordinate, well, and they will coordinate with ADEC, and will conduct diving tests for submerged oil using a small submersible submarine. That will be in Uyak Bay, Uganic Bay, and Hallo Bay. Also, because of the concern that the villagers in Chignik have for protecting the hatchery and